with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
And I'm Louis Fertel. Obviously, the Tony nominations are out. We'll get to that in a second. But first, I want to say something about a former Tony nominee, an honorary Tony winner, who made some waves on social media yesterday. Are you familiar with an artist named Barbra Streisand? Because she has been typing.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Melissa McCarthy posted a picture of her and Adam Shankman.
Friend
of the show, fan of Keep It. And Barbra Streisand posted on the on her Instagram, give him my regards. Are you on Ozempic? And I can only assume she thought that was a DM, and she has never sent a DM in her life and didn't really know what was going on there. All I know is I read that fucking post, which is so crazy to read and is still up as far as I know. And I can only read it in the voice of Barbra Streisand in What's Up, Doc, where she says, where she would say it something like, give him my regards. Are you on Ozempic? There we go. That's my impression.
That's a beautiful Barbra impersonation.
Thank you.
I definitely saw that, of course. And I hated that people on the internet immediately jumped to, it's gross and invasive, asking Melissa McCarthy that. It's like, it's clearly, it was supposed to be a DM.
Yes, right. And they have a previous relationship. Melissa McCarthy sang with her on that album of duets she did a few years ago.
Yeah, they're clearly friends. And of course it is. We've seen things like this. I feel like one, Kathy Hilton always comments on Instagram like this. And I also think most of our parents and grandparents or aunts, they're all people who are boomer age, maybe older, and they will just comment on your Instagram as if they are leaving you a personal message.
Oh, no. I mean, like, I remember somebody in my life posted about the Oscars, like, I mostly liked it. Or something like that. It's like, did it have to be public? Did it have to be public the way you said that?
Or call me. It's what my grandmother will write sometimes.
Call me.
You have my number.
Okay, we can get into the real Tonys now. Not too many surprises other than Here Lies Love is just totally not here at all. I was surprised not to see a single nomination for it.
Yeah, well, the title of the play is apt. I walked over the grave.
Paid your respects.
I didn't love that show anyway. And I think that, I don't know, it's first of all, it had the controversy because musicians hated it. A lot of musicians hated it because they wanted to, you know, have the canned music in it. But also, that is the music of David Byrne, you know, and Fatboy Slim. So that's sort of what you'd expect. It's a weird mashup, I guess, for a Broadway show. It never really felt like a show to me. It felt like a lot of songs about a topic and then a weirdly strung together story. And it felt like I was watching karaoke, to be honest. Like, the way they're moving around. The show didn't really give Conrad Rickamore and Ariel Jacobs sort of much to go with. I don't know. I felt like the story was just very eh. Conrad Rickamore... we'll have another chance for a nomination next year, though, because O Mary is transferring to Broadway.
Yes, which I know we talked about this on the show. That's Cola Scola performing as Married Todd Lincoln, a very zany, at wit's end Married Todd Lincoln. Though, honestly, when you look at Married Todd Lincoln, there's a lot going on in her life. They could have gotten into. She was a notorious shopaholic, for one thing. Anyway, it's a very funny play, and they will both be in the running next year when this show inevitably explodes once it hits Broadway.
I'm sorry. I want to know the concept of being a shopaholic and, you know, four score ago or whenever Lincoln was president. Because you're just hopping in the buggy.
Yeah, right.
Going into town and walking into the store. I'll take everything.
Yeah, which is what? A copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin? I mean, what's available? elsewhere on the Tony situation, Best Actress in a Play is very exciting to me. We have Amy Ryan in Doubt, who took over very last minute from, I believe it was Cherry Jones, and Sarah Paulson, Inappropriate, ex of Cherry Jones. Rachel McAdams and Mary Jane, I am so excited to see this play. I think she seems like she's on stage the entire time. Very emotional story. Thrilled. Jessica Lange in Mother Play, she last won a Tony for Long Day's Journey and Tonight, which I believe is still going. I left the theater sometime in the halfway zone. No, actually, it was phenomenal. She was wonderful in that. And then Betsy Adam in Prayer for the French Republic. But that's a star-studded category.
Yeah. My prayer is to prayer for the French Republic. I'm not thinking about that play or supporting it. But lead actress, that is so interesting to publicly know that they're exes and in the same category together, because how often does that happen? For the men in categories, I just assume.
Right. No, well, it's like that one Oscars where Leslie Manville and Gary Oldman were both nominated. And I'm like, I don't want Leslie to have to see him that night. This is her night. And then he won and she didn't. Anyway, life's bad all of the time. Also, something happened here that I fucking hate, which is featured actress in a musical has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 nominees. No. Can I make a plea right here? All award shows need to have 5 nominees in every category. We want to see that. I don't want to see 10 Best Picture nominees. I will settle for, if it's a slim year, 3 nominees for maybe Best Play or something like that. That I can do too. But 5, or on rare occasions, 3. Everything else, I don't want to see. Like at the Emmys, when there are 8 supporting nominees up for something, and like there's always doubles from the same show, it's not giving imagination. I don't like to see it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the nominations, Best New Play, I think, rooting for Stereophonic, although I quite liked Jaja's African Hair Braiding by Jocelyn Bio. My friend Nana Mensah is in it as well. So, I mean, a win for that would be great. I'm hearing fantastic things about Mary Jane, and I'm excited to see it. It is not about the ganja, unfortunately, but, you know, she's doing her thing in it.
Okay, very good. I'm actually excited to see Pearly Victorious, which is written by Ossie Davis.
It's good.
Oh, you saw it. Yeah, it's 60 years old.
It is very good.
And the costume designer for it, who was nominated, is Emilio Sosa, who was a Project Runway runner-up on season 7. He lost to, I believe, Seth Aaron Henderson on that. A really good season, underrated season.
Friend of Keep It, Juan Ramirez, former guest co-host for one of our Broadway episodes, did deceive me by taking me to see Pearly Victorious, which I thought was a revival of the musical Pearly, and it was instead a revival of the play Pearly Victorious, which has no music in it.
And also no Victoria Justice. I just want to say that too.
I'm like, Leslie Odom Jr., I want to see you singing. But he was great. And Kara Young is fantastic in it. So.
Oh, by the way, congrats to Juliana Canfield, our guest last week, who was nominated for Stereophonic. I want to say that first. Controversial nomination. Eddie Redmayne is nominated for that cabaret thing where he gets to be as gay as he wants. Now, I remember you saying you liked this performance. Juan Ramirez, the aforementioned, hated this performance. Explain this to me. What's going on here?
Here's the thing about cabaret. It is very polarizing.
I think it's my favorite movie musical, for one thing.
Yes. Polarizing because, for one, there's Eddie, who's playing the MC. And, he's playing it with all the gusto of a Power Rangers villain.
Oh, okay. We got Scorpina going. We got Rita Repulsa going.
There's a lot of mugging. There's a lot of hand movements, a little bit like you dancing.
Okay.
So, you know.
All right.
But I don't know. He's playing it big and some people don't like it. I like it. Although I will say he's playing it big because of this production of the show is just sort of huge.
Mm.
But the show itself, I'm not much of a fan of. Like, B.B. Newworth is nominated. We love B.B. Newworth, but I just feel like she was swallowed up by this play and the stage.
Also, you know? She's still doing this shit, huh? It's like Hal Holbrook is Mark Twain. We can't get her out of Chicago. Like, she needs to be pried with a spatula out of this world.
it's back and forth. What I will say is that, I don't know if you saw that review of it by Mamala's niece, Mina Harris.
Oh, yes.
Where it said, critics don't like cabaret, young women do, because it, you know, she talked about how Sally Bowles decides to choose to survive, and it's about abortion rights or what the fuck ever, kind of weird lens that you would put on it if you were, you know, taking a girl boss to the theater.
And I often am.
Sally Bowles, I mean, the play really is about how this bitch is just like doing the jitterbug while Nazis are rising to power.
Correct.
So she doesn't give a fuck. She wants to go like Elsie. She's like, okay, I want to drink. I want to do my pills. I got rid of the baby. Have fun in Paris.
All I know is you're going to feel sorry once James Corden starts playing Sally Bowles. So enjoy it now. Enjoy it now.
There is a thing that tends to happen sometimes in big ensemble casts, in film particularly, and in, it always happens at the Emmys, where the cast of Stereophonic is all competing against one another.
Right. It's the modern familyization of award shows, yes.
Yes, but Douglas Lyons, a fantastic playwright who I know, was tweeting about the fact that the Tonys should really add a best ensemble category at this point, because there are ways to celebrate, I'm not even just talking about the Stereophonic cast, you know, I just feel like so much goes into a Broadway play, and particularly a Broadway musical, I feel like, where even if a show doesn't win, like, best new musical, right, or best new play, but you still feel like, I don't know, the cast was giving,
yeah.
Even if the playwright or director weren't, there's a way to honor those people, and I think that, you know, giving more people awards is never a bad thing, and especially when they're people who I just feel like work as hard as Broadway performers who are doing that shit 8 times a week.
I will disagree and say that I think there are too many Grammys, and it has lessened my interest in who wins a Grammy. But I will say, in the wake of the Oscar for Best Casting that we're getting, there's sort of an in for this to occur. So I think that's somewhat realistic. But anyway, I guess we should get on with the episode. What on earth is happening today? I haven't really read the outline, Ira. What's happening?
You're just like Larry King.
Oh my God. When you look at his old interviews, he is so, there's no other word for it, disappointing. He is waiting for someone to just keep talking so he can say little to nothing and act curious about whatever is on the note card that he didn't write in front of him.
I think that once you're doing it as long as he was doing it, and then once we got to a point where, you know, you're just listening to, like, radio, not as intently as probably you would have been paying attention to interviews back then. You know, like, everyone's been interviewed to death at this point. Mm-hmm. I feel like probably by osmosis he started learning things about guests.
I would hope he had his ear to the sand somehow. Who knows what was going on with him, but yeah.
But you can't really be interviewing someone and like, who are you?
Yeah.
It's like you're meeting your boyfriend's uncle for the first time.
Yes,
at a family event. Who are you? Didn't know he was gay.
We'll be right back. Yeah.
So our episode this week, we've got Challengers,
which is
finally out. Lewis and I love it.
I mean, like, we'll get into it and how actually I feel bad for my usually extremely primed critical faculties in this moment. I'll explain why I don't feel I have access to them. But yes, we'll discuss Challengers.
And Nicole Kidman, we're going to talk about her because she was recently honored by the American Film Institute with a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Of course, extremely well-deserved. It was a pleasure over the weekend to revisit some of her filmography. And also, Meryl's toast to her at the AFI Awards, sensational. Mm. Somebody else just brought up to me, how does this woman not have a memoir yet? This woman turned 75 this year. Hey, Meryl, let's get going. I know you wrote that courtroom speech in Kramer versus Kramer, so I know you have a pen or a computer or whatever. Let's get it on paper.
Yeah, we only have in existence the fantastic book, Her Again?
Yes, by Michael Shulman.
I need more. I need the My Name is Barbara treatment from Meryl.
Right.
Okay?
I want to know who was treating Meryl like shit on the set. Yeah. Allegedly, Dustin Hoffman like threw a plate at the wall and didn't tell Meryl. I need to know those types of stories.
Yeah. I need to know she hated Heartburn as much as we do.
Oh, yeah. The book is really enjoyable. The movie, not as much.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about Nicole Kidman in general, our favorite performances of her.
Certainly.
What we think of her as a celebrity. Where the fuck is the sequel to the AMC ad? We were promised it.
And we also, like, they like, chopped up the last one and just gave us a couple different angles. Not what I wanted. Sorry.
Yeah. And then also we will be joined by the fantastic Chris Perfetti from Abbott Elementary, who is also a fantastic theater actor himself.
And he is one, in one of these things called a television comedy, which if you've listened to Jerry Seinfeld, you know this is an endangered species and we're not allowed to be funny anymore. So it's actually illegal for them to be doing what they're doing, which is saying jokes on television.
Which is very silly, being like, oh, you can't put the shows on that you used to put on anymore. I mean, I have it on good authority that Abbott Elementary is just reusing Welcome Back, Kotter scripts.
I've never put them next to each other like that. The juxtaposition is obvious now. Gabe Kaplan, we love you.
All right, we'll be back with more Keep It. We want you to know something. We're not just disembodied voices with flawless opinions and incredible taste. We're also pretty faces.
But don't take our word for it. Check us out on our YouTube channel, which has the loveliest commenters ever. I was just looking at them and not commenting, just leering like a witch. Type Keep It into your nearest YouTube search bar and make sure to follow us so you never miss an episode.
Much like Vanessa Williams' music career, sex is back, baby.
Can we talk about that song for 2 seconds? Okay. Vanessa Williams has a new dance song. Is it called Keep On Dancing or Legs?
It's called Legs.
Legs, okay. Great song. Love her in the video. She's obviously scintillating, beautiful, gray eyes, underrated. The sentiment is a little grim. They say the legs are the last to go. I'm a keep dancing. Yes. As if she is saying, the rest of me has atrophied. But allow me to levitate onto the dance floor and bounce around. Love her. Love her.
I will say, she's eaten up some of the pop girls in that video. At least dance-wise.
Yeah, danceable songs. Remember those?
Yeah. And she's moving. I'm not going to drag another one of our favorite pop stars, because I do actually adore this woman, and her album is coming out this week, and we will be discussing it on next week's episode, if you can guess who that is. But when Vanessa Williams was moving, I definitely did not see her counting dance moves.
Well, when you have to have the talent for the pageant competitions, you know, you get the, you prime it, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, but speaking of legs, the movie Challengers, starring Zendaya, Mike Feist, and Josh O'Connor, Luca Guadagnino's latest film. Baby, it is about legs.
Quite. Oh, my God. And also, like, how clothes hang on these athletic bodies. I think there's something specific to almost all of Luca's films. And this is strange to identify, because his films really are extremely different. Like, this does not remind me of Suspiria, which does not remind me of A Bigger Splash, whatever. But like this and Call Me By Your Name in particular, there's just something where you're watching how the clothes touch these bodies and as they walk around. It's extremely palpable feeling. Mm-hmm. Like it's not just sensual. It's like, oh, there's texture that seems to be on me as I'm watching this movie. And that's just one of the many pleasures of Challengers.
Even Suspiria, with just like the costumes the dancers wear, and even the intense athleticism that I feel like is displayed within that film. You get that in this. And it's, I don't know, I really enjoy watching his movies.
Totally. No, he's one of my favorite directors. Even like Bones and All is maybe my least favorite that I've seen of his. And even that had its pleasures.
Oh, I fucking love that movie.
Oh, you do?
I hate Suspiria.
Suspiria is like too much. And there is a little bit of a shout out to it in this movie where, I don't think I'm spoiling much, Zendaya breaks a bone. And the way they zoom in on it was straight up out of that Witch Academy. I did not need to see it that close.
Yeah, that's a scene where you can see it's coming, because the film is told in non-chronological order.
Yeah, almost torturously, actually. That's, I mean, like, it works for the movie, but it's also, like, it's confusing. And also when the movie starts, you're like, so are we going to really be seeing a version of these characters 11 years younger all the time? Like, are they really going to pull it off? But it works on you. You believe it after
it
a
does.
While.
I do think that, I mean, this will be one of the very few critical things we have to say about this movie, because it's sort of hard to think critically about this film. I mean, shout out to the people who have, but it's just fun.
Yes.
It's sexy. The soundtrack by Trent Reznor, Atticus, Boys Noize. I felt like I was at the club.
I mean, I haven't stopped playing that soundtrack since I've... It's all I can say about this movie is I never have this feeling. Last time I felt this way was Get Ready, Call Me By Your Name. Mm. You're so in the world of this movie and you don't want to leave it.
Yeah.
So the soundtrack kind of keeps you there, and the music is both clubby it's very now, which is kind of unusual for a soundtrack. I feel like most soundtracks have like a throwback vibe a certain way. This feels very 2024. You feel like you're at a warehouse party or something like that. But also, the intensity of it, it has this Final Boss quality where like it's electronic, but you're also in the head of a competitive person. So there's this like rumbling undertone to this throbbing kind of horny music. And you feel like you're in the headspace of somebody who wants to win and is putting a lot of pressure on themselves. It's that's really well realized in this music.
Yeah, so the film starts chronologically with Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor battling each other in a match. And then we go back in time and we sort of see the deterioration of their relationship as best friends and see how Zendaya plays a part in this. And then we keep cutting back and forth to the match and jumping around in time. And I will say the one thing that works with the mixed chronology of the film is that by the time you get to, you know, the end of the match again, when we start zooming in different POVs in the match, I feel like I'm fully inside their characters where that works for me.
Yes.
But I don't know. I'm like, I feel like either we should have done like a Harold Pinter betrayal thing where maybe we start here at the end, then move backwards to the beginning and then jump right back to the end again or something else. But at a certain point, the jumping back and forth from different times was very dizzying to me. And I get that it was to sort of hide a bit of the soapy twist of the story. But I think that twists in soap operas are always predicated on you giving a fuck about the characters anyway. So I think that we didn't need the mystery of, oh, that's why this has happened, because this has happened in the past. I think that if we just saw those events unfold in real time, they'd still have the same impact.
And also, like, when you're looking at how the characters are different looking earlier on than now, sometimes it's not immediately apparent. So as I'm watching a scene, sometimes I didn't know which era we were in, you know. You can always figure it out, but it always takes an extra second of adjustment because it moves around a whole lot. But by the way, it just something that is awesome about this movie is the drama really is just about these three people. There is like a line judge played by Zendaya's real life assistant who's in the movie.
He's so fucking good.
Very funny. Josh O'Connor has a Tinder date at some point. But otherwise, it's all about these three people and the constantly shifting power dynamics. As I said, here comes some Gene Shalit for you. It put the tennis in Tennessee Williams. I mean, it's all about the drama churning between these three people. It feels like it should be a play.
Well, you know what? I'm going to give you your 10s for that.
Love, 15. Yes.
No, you're right. I brought up Harold Pinter's betrayal, but it's just like there is something about a... Usually you get this in plays more, but there's just really something about a film that... And it feels classic Hollywood film to me, you know? Where you just sort of have three main characters and it is about the changing power dynamics and it swings back and forth with such good precision that no one really comes off as ultimately the most evil person within the triangle. Like there's always someone who's at fault. Although I will say Art, Mike Feist, is a demon and a snake.
He starts off the demon behavior early in the movie. Mm-hmm. He starts interloping between what's happening with Josh O'Connor and Zendaya. But something else I want to say about the music in this movie, which we've already described, sometimes I'll just blast it over a conversation between two people. And I love that because that to me is classic Hollywood. You know, think of, you know, Bette Davis unleashing some monologue as the strings kick up. It really took me back to something like that, like putting this crazy heft over just what somebody is saying. You just never hear that anymore. I overheard somebody at work being like, did they need to play the music at all those times? But the answer is, of course they didn't. The directorial decision is so interesting. It makes it so memorable. I remember those, there's a particular scene in a sauna between the two guys where the music is just pumping super loud as they cut each other down to size. And because of that, it's this utterly specific moment in movies. Like, I don't think I will ever forget that scene.
Yeah, I think that to bring up the soap opera aspect of it, again, you know, you can get a bit sort of cliched and overwrought where you just hear like these strings, you know, behind like a big dramatic conversation, right? But because this music is different, because it is like this club music, because it's going for a specific feel, I think it highlights those scenes in the way that music used to do in those films before it became, you know, sort of a crutch to just put a song behind a conversation. And I think what really works for it too is the music isn't telling you how to feel. The yeah. scene is telling you how to feel. The music isn't like sad, or it's not telling you there's danger happening, you know? Like, you're still interpreting it from the scene. And you brought up the how the film sounds current. And that's also what I really liked about it. It's set in 2006, right? And mm-hmm. I love like a throwback moment.
Certainly.
But
what do you think this podcast is? My yeah. God. Our references? You'd think I'm 93 years old. Come on.
You are.
I wait till they find out. It's like a Kenneth and 30 Rock situation.
But the music, you know, there's a scene where they're kissing, where two characters are kissing, and a Blood Orange song plays instead of like a song from 2006.
Yeah.
So it never feels steeped in nostalgia too much, at least with the music. It lets you stay in the present and you're just telling a story about the past. But shout out to the moments that we do get. Like, when I saw Applebee's, and I knew it was Applebee's the minute we were inside that restaurant, I was gagging.
Also, there's a lot of product placement in this movie. That, like, it actually says something about how successful the vibe is of the movie, that it never becomes overbearing, but there is quite a bit of it. One thing I will say, if I have to make a criticism. So, Zendaya is a former tennis player who injures herself and then becomes the manager of Mike Faye's character, who then becomes this sort of under-motivated tennis player who's like never becoming a big star. Like, she doesn't really get him to the highest tier, or he kind of falls from that tier. They have a moment where they're about to have sex and she's talking about tennis, and that's really like getting her into the sex. And then he says he doesn't want to talk about that, and she immediately jumps off. It is very Faye Dunaway in Network, you know, where she's, it's all business and wants to talk about business, and she's talking about ratings in the middle of having sex. That said, that kind of, I mean, I guess I'll call it tunnel vision, almost psychotic drive that the Zendaya character has, I feel like Zendaya left a little bit of the potential for an interesting psychotic character on the table. I felt like she played it that part of the character a little too cool. And by the way, her cool is essential to the movie. Like, you need to believe that these two people are obsessed with her. And when they meet her early in the movie, you are as transfixed by her as they are. So it really works. But I wonder if maybe we could have gotten something a little bit more outwardly psycho from her.
Yeah. I will say that the film sort of is really about the relationship between Art and Patrick. Those are their two characters'
yes.
names. And it's funny that everyone's been bringing up, how gay is this film? Because, you know, there's the whole three-way aspect of it. It's not as gay as you think in terms of sex, but it is very gay. And the fact that it's really about these two men being in love with each other.
And also, like, the drama going on in their head, right? Like, yeah. that reminds me of Call Me By Your Name, too, where it's so much about this person going over, like, the possibilities of what could happen with this person. And, you know, that percolating sense of something raw about to happen.
He does longing very well, and there are moments, like, especially that sauna scene that you brought up, where you're like, you're wondering, like, are these two about to have sex?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that is the undercurrent in their relationship the entire time. And even if it's never consummated, you know that they both know that that is probably, like, something that they thought of.
Correct.
In terms of each other. And I think that that is such an interesting way to depict a story between two men who are very close, because I feel like those relationships exist with, I mean, they exist with gay men, you know, who are close friends who maybe have never even had sex with each other, but they're very close. But with straight men too, you know, there is this sort of thing that sometimes goes unaddressed in relationships. But I will say that it's really their film is my critique.
Yeah, right.
And just that Zendaya, maybe there's parts that she could have played a little bit differently. I would have liked if she'd gone sort of that psycho route, as you meant. But I will also say that the film doesn't really give her any scenes to really depict anything besides I'm cool. You know, except for one scene later where she's slipping out of the hotel room to have a clandestine meeting. But and there's a moment where she slaps Josh O'Connor, spits in his face. But needed something else, you know? I don't need to see her killing a puppy or something, but, like, you need to see something where, like, Tashi, this bitch is a little unhinged.
Yeah,
and I think she was not completely serviced within the play.
Also, I have to say, this is one of those things that's becoming a Carly Rae Jepsen emotion situation where the box office does not feel like everybody in the universe is running up to see it, and yet all of our friends have seen it 3 times. And in fact, we want to keep re-seeing it. What do you think it is about this movie that isn't capturing everybody else's imagination? Because once I heard it was amazing, I had to go see it. And I'm verifying to everybody in sight that they should see it.
Well, one, I think that this movie has the potential to be word of mouth.
I hope so.
In a success. Because first of all, I've been telling everybody, you need to see Challenges. You need to see Challenges. But also, I do get what you're saying, because I was at a party on Saturday telling multiple friends they need to go see Challenges. And half the people I was telling didn't know what the fuck Challenges was.
Right. No. And it stars one of the biggest stars we have. Like, I know you saw the fucking Dune movies. You know who Zendaya is. So, this is something I usually don't care about. It has a B+ cinema score, which, which to me says people like us love it. And then some people out there are really down on it. I wonder if that's a reading on the gay material. I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the gayness of it all. I don't know how the Zendaya of it all isn't translating to it being a bigger hit. But I will also say that running this film right after Dune, I feel like because she's been so dominant in runways, and just this sort of, it feels like the whole first part of the year has been Zendaya.
Yeah.
Maybe it sort of bled together and people are just like, is she still just promoting Dune?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
So there's a bit of that, but there's also just, I don't know, it's her leading this film, but also not really being the lead of the film. And it is two actors who are still sort of unknown. I think that in another universe, or maybe even a few years ago, you put three actors who are all the same level as Zendaya in it, maybe people are going to see it a bit more. You know, like if it's Zendaya and Tom Holland and, I don't know, like Timothée Chalamet.
Right. And there's a world, of course, where that happened. Right. That does sort of make sense. I will say also on that front, maybe it's also just because it's an adult movie. Like nothing about this has like broad comedy in it or like the typical, like, one person comes out the winner at the end. In fact, something I love about this movie is all three of them, in specific ways, multiple ways, are losers. You know, like, it's not just we won the big game at the end, or somebody has a clear path to what happens next. And in fact, the ending is also extremely nebulous. I'm sure that's a part of the cinema score, too. You know?
Yeah. They all lose something at the end of the film, but I will say two of them gain the most important prize. And that...
Are you crying?
Is friendship. Yeah, I don't know. The movie did make me really emotional. Like, I was really hooked on the friendship between both of them. And, you know, I just think that, I don't know, I want more stories about men being friends in cinema.
And feeling like there's stakes there, too. I think something I love, the thing I love most about this movie is it's about competitiveness, which has so much in it for people. It has, for one thing, pettiness, right? Like it's all ego-oriented, et cetera. But then also it's passion. And that means like you're intensely thinking about other people, which can turn into feelings of romance and angst and things like that. So I just thought it really captured both the soul and the pettiness of competition. I find that just a rare thing for a movie to tackle. By the way, it doesn't remind me of many other movies too. The only one I could really think of, I'll think two things. There's a movie from the late 60s that's Barbara Hershey's debut called Last Summer. I think I brought it up on this show before. It's this weird movie where she befriends these two guys and they have a kind of quasi-queer relationship going on. And then they meet this other girl who's very weird, doesn't know how to socialize. She's awkward. And they all kind of turn on her. Anyway, that's something about that dynamic between three people that has a somewhat queer thing going on. And then secondly... there's a movie written and directed by Robert Towne, who did Chinatown, Shampoo, et cetera, called Personal Best with Mariel Hemingway, which is about a track star. And like the way, the sweatiness of her body as she runs, it captures sort of the passion and competition that I rarely see in a sports movie.
Yeah, I mean, it ain't Philadelphia Story. It's not Screwball in terms of one of those triangles. But yeah, I just really love this movie. And I will say lastly, this one was written by Justin Kuritsis, who is partners with Celine Song.
Yes.
Who did...
Past Lives.
Past Lives is also about a love triangle. And I need to know who this person is.
Yes.
Because they have both written about something that seems extremely personal to them. And I need to know, who's this third person? And when are they going to talk their shit?
Yeah. What's the triangulation? I want to know who the hypotenuse is in this situation.
Yeah. And I think that their film has the potential to be a banger.
Yeah, right. Step on up.
Yeah. Anyway, my cinema score is an A.
Mine's also an A. I cannot wait to see it again.
I'm literally going to see it again.
Yes. In fact, I regret having not seen it twice before this podcast. That's how much I want to see it again.
I need to go see it on... Go see this movie on a date.
Definitely.
Go see it on a date and bring someone else.
Or crash somebody else's date. You know what I mean? Just sit too close to a couple and see what happens for you.
Yeah. All right. When we're back, we're joined by Chris Perfetti. This week's guest has become the favorite white boy of everyone with a Hulu account. And when he's not molding the PC minds of tomorrow, he's on stage starring in works like the LeBron James-inspired play, King James, which I adored. Please welcome to Keep It, Abbott Elementary's very own Chris Perfetti.
Hi, Ira. Hi, Lewis.
All right, pick one right away. TV or stage? Go.
Stage every day of the week. Stage.
Really? I'm actually somewhat surprised to hear that. How come?
I don't know. You know, I think that's where I trained. That's like, that feels, it feels the most like acting to me. You know, it's doing a play is an infinitely more collaborative medium, I feel like. The actor is so in control on stage in a way that they're not in TV and film. And so I guess I'm just a control freak. And so that's where I'm happiest.
Okay, so I have to ask that, you know, like, obviously, you know, we've actually gotten a lot of actors lately who have been talking about theater just in that sort of regard. And I have to wonder...
Like who?
Are there, you know, who recently, Lewis?
Juliana Canfield.
Juliana Canfield. We talked to
Carla
her
Gugino,
recently.
Yes.
Yeah. And I have to imagine a show like Abbott Elementary... is a lot different than just the regular show, because I feel like there are a lot of moving pieces all the time, and maybe that lends itself to the I'm not in control of the entire thing. I mean, you have just your regular actors, you have kids actors, you have managing the schedules of when you can shoot with children, etc. Like, explain how crazy it is filming this show and how stressful it is.
You know, it's honestly, I think people would be shocked to learn that, I mean, especially now, you know, we just wrapped our third season and really the majority of our crew has been with us since the pilot. And that is very humbling and exciting, and it makes this work environment feel like home. But I think at this point, like, and truly, honestly, from the jump, because, you know, Quinta really, really created an environment of just flow and inspiration and ease and comfortability. But I think if I were to finish this sentence, I've started three times now, people would be surprised to learn how chill the set of Abbott Elementary is. You know, we have to work very quickly in order to make the show. We kind of crank out an episode a week. And so it feels like a well-oiled machine at this point. And there is so much talent in front of and behind the camera that it's really just sort of this like balletic, symbiotic thing that's happening right now, where our camera operators just kind of can guess where we're going and what we want to do. And we've been lucky enough to have so many of our directors come back and direct multiple episodes. And so we have a shorthand now where I feel like making the show is just very easy and satisfying. But yes, there are also droves of kids and, you know what it's like to create a comedy, especially a sitcom. You know, the amount of jokes that are left on the that are strewn on the floor of of our set. It's a very fast and furious process. And so that's also really what's exhilarating about it. You know, I'm very used to, as I said, spending a month figuring out what a story is with your family in a rehearsal room and sort of learning to be comfortable with whatever it's going to be and the permanence of it that used to plague me in TV and film. And now I'm addicted to it. I love not knowing what take they're going to use. I love not knowing what joke is going to make it into the final cut. And I love being in an environment where anything can happen. You know, in theater, the work really becomes about how to make this same story real for yourself every night. And on Abbott, the work is, I feel like, really just trying to tickle myself and make my co-stars break. You know, that's how it, you know, remains alive for me.
Now, your character on the show, Jacob, is basically the Pollyanna of the school, you know, like eternally optimistic, helpful, etc. Have you had a favorite moment where we learned something about your character or he got to do something that would be unexpected to the viewer that you got to play?
It's wild. Playing a character this long is obviously not something I really expected to do or was on my bucket list. But one of the beautiful things that affords you, one, me, is there is a room of experts on Jacob that are constantly coming up with things that Jacob has done, desires of his, fears of his. And so, yeah, I would say every episode I'm learning something ridiculous about what one-man show Jacob has done, what college he's applied to and didn't get into. So yeah, it's kind of hard to pick. I think I particularly loved this storyline that Jacob was a part of the Story Pirates.
Yes.
That's, you know, mm-hmm. growing up in New York doing theater and, you know, popping into drama bookshop. That was like something that I thought, you know, that was very real for me. And I thought that was really such a funny, connection that he would have. And, but yeah, it's weird. It's like I have at this point sort of like chalked up. I'm learning about Jacob in real time along with our audience, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. What's so fun about like a sitcom character too is that, especially what is a good sitcom, you know, where you are learning things about the character. Really good writers sort of make it feel like they feel like a full person sort of by the time you're done with the entire series. Because, I mean, it made total sense that Jacob applied to Morehouse. And it made perfect sense that from this most recent episode that you are constantly sending your coworkers newsletters and emails that they don't read.
Yeah, there's sort of like an endless trove of... we have really, really talented writers and producers. And yeah, I think in terms of what you said about trying to come up with real life examples, you know, comedy is difficult, you know, writing jokes is difficult because you sort of have to tread a fine line of keeping your audience and knowing and having the trust of an audience. And if you write characters that are two-dimensional or sort of cartoonish, I think you roll the dice and you potentially lose people's empathy for them. And and I think it's inherent in this genre, this medium of mockumentary that, like, you know, if we're doing our job well, we should hopefully dupe you a little bit into believing that this could be happening somewhere actually in the world. You know, that's why we shoot it that way. And so, yeah, I think we have to strive to make them as authentic and three-dimensional and multifaceted and flawed as possible, all while trying to write jokes, which is harder than you'd think. And there's a lot of comedies that don't write jokes.
Shots fired. Okay. Yeah.
Speaking of empathy for a character, I want to revisit a character you played in a show called Looking, which I loved.
Thanks, Ira.
This show has, you know, not had its Girls, Sex of the City moment where people are rewatching and discovering how now they hate some of these characters now. But people did sort of really hate Jonathan Groff's character a lot while watching it. But I also have to wonder, how do you feel about your character now, or how did you feel about that character while you were on the show? Because I feel like we emotionally liked Jonathan Groff so much, and we kind of, you know, liked Russell Tovey's character, that, you know, when you came into the picture, I found your character intensely annoying. But now revisiting it, I'm like, actually, you were just sort of a normal human being dealing with two awful people.
Thank you. Finally. I feel like I'm just finishing reading the treasure trove of think pieces about what an awful person Brady was.
There were a lot.
That's not true. I don't read that shit. But thank you for saying that. Thank you for saying that you didn't like him, because I feel like that's kind of like a supreme compliment. He was a complicated and troubled dude, and he was an asshole at times. I think he had a lot going on. But that honestly, I feel like, not to be too corny, like, really prepared me, I feel like, for the work that I'm doing on Abbott right now, weirdly enough, because, you know, there's so much embracing of the unknown and sort of like jumping off of cliffs that is required in to be on the set of Abbott Elementary. And Looking was such a remarkable and unique shooting experience in that, you know, we had scripts, but so much of the tone of that show and the conceit of that show and the feeling of that show was about capturing a feeling. And so we would go into shooting things not really knowing what we were going to shoot and sort of knowing the plot and the arc of a episode, but trusting that we would kind of put it together based off of something that felt organic to us. And that scared the ever-loving shit out of me, you know, because I was very used to, and still am very used to not doing that. But it was a great time. That's also like a particular experience where I feel like, you know, I also hate when actors say this, but like, it's a group of people that I think of very fondly and that had such a huge impact on my life. I have so much affection for everybody who was a part of that show, acting in it and designing on it and writing for it. And so it's just kind of stuck with me.
I have to say, it's funny that you hate when actors say things like that, and then you go and say something like that. I mean, like, do you find yourself having a lot of contempt for when actors give interviews and are sincere about what they do?
I have a lot of contempt for actors in general, but I just think everybody thinks they have the best. Everybody thinks they have the best cast, or they had the best time shooting that thing, and they're wrong, because I have the best cast.
See,
They are the cast of Abbott Elementary.
I want to say also about King James, the play you did. You started at the Steppenwolf, and I'm always curious when actors are in Chicago, because I mean, it's just where I grew up. I think of it as like a fun, rowdy town. But like, what does an actor do like during their time living just in Chicago, which is, you know, a city that doesn't revolve around the theater industry, for example?
Yeah, but theater. I mean, Chicago is probably the second biggest theater town in our beautiful country. And so that was nice to be. I mean, obviously, I've spent 10 years in New York doing plays on and off Broadway, and going to Chicago to start King James was the first time I had been anywhere else to do a play. And I was surprised to see how much a part of the culture it is there. It's not a weird thing to go and see a play like it is in L.A., that was beautiful. I really enjoyed being in Chicago. I find the people of Chicago so incredible. I'm slightly embarrassed to say that, like, I have a lot more to learn about Chicago. When I'm working on a play, and particularly a new play, I tend to, hibernate. And right. So, you know, it was a 2-hour, 2-person play. And so we each had 120 pages of lines to remember. And so I was truly like walking from the theater to my apartment to rehearse in my apartment and then go back to rehearsal the next day. But Steppenwolf is one of those places that, you know, if I told 18-year-old Chris that you were going to work there, I don't think I would have believed it. I grew up just so attracted to the work coming out of there and to the actors that got their start there. And I still believe very strongly in what that company stands for and what they do. And so it was really surreal to be on that stage. I used to have an aunt who lived in Chicago, and I went to visit her expressly under the conditions that she would take me to a play at Steppenwolf. I think I said, like, I won't come unless we can go into town and like see a play at Steppenwolf. And so I spent like my spring break 1 year in high school in Chicago and saw a play there. So that experience was just like a dream come true. And the process of bringing that play to life was also really groovy, like one of the things I'll remember for a very long time. And we were lucky enough to get to do the play in LA and in New York. And that is a wild thing that actors don't usually, that's a gift that I haven't been afforded before. You know, usually once a play is over, that's when I get all of my good ideas about it. I'm like, oh, that's what that meant. Or God, we should have done that. Cause the wheels just stop turning and it settles a bit and you, have some objective perspective, but, we got to do the play 3 times. And so it was the first time that I've left a play and I didn't want to do it again. and so, you know, maybe in a year I'll want to do it again, but it was amazing.
This is not the kind of spring break you hear about on MTV, by the way. Just like
Steppenwolf, your top off.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Lewis was busy at the Barnes & Noble or something, you know.
Immersed.
I was immersed in theater in Chicago. I worked as an usher at Menopause the Musical for 2 years.
It's a long menopause.
Immersed.
Yeah.
No, I love Chicago theater. I studied at Loyola Chicago. And I want to know, what was the play that you saw at Steppenwolf? Do you remember?
It was August Osage County.
Oh, that's one of the big ones. Yes. I saw Tracy Letson, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf there. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I worked at August Osage County when it went to Broadway. I was a bartender during previews.
I was in drama school by that time, and I was in New York when they were doing it on Broadway. And I think it's the only play that I've seen more than once. And I dare say I saw it 4 times. You know, because they did it for quite a while and they kept, you know, changing the cast up. And it was like one of those formative experiences. But I guess you saw it more than 4 times, Ira.
Yeah, but, you know, doing that, it's always weird watching a play from that sort of vantage point. Because it's some nights you will see Act 1 and then some nights you just won't see Act 2 and then mixing it up and everything. But, yeah, it was a great production, and I served Glenn Close a drink once, so that was great.
I'm sure she needed one. I would love to see her pound the $27 double whatever they give you at those plays.
You want to see her pounding a drink now? You just got to go to Cafe Clooney in the West Village. She is always there. Chris, thank you so much for being here.
Oh my gosh, it's so great to talk to you guys. I love your show, and it's
thank you.
Honor to be with you.
I love your show.
Thanks, man.
You know, so yeah, we just love each other. Great.
it's such a pleasurable show. So congrats for filming your 3rd season.
Thanks, Lewis. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. After decades as one of Hollywood's preeminent leading ladies, Nicole Kidman has received the American Film Institute Lifetime Achievement Award. Because why? She makes movies better.
Ah, she even said it herself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about those movies, from our favorite Nicole Kidman performances to some of our blind spots. I fixed one of my blind spots and started over the weekend with Dead Calm.
What did you think of Dead Calm?
I kind of loved it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think it's like, it's totally wacky and of its time, and it's sort of an interesting movie where I feel like, first of all, she looks completely different.
Yeah, right.
That. And I, you know, we're not even talking about just you like I always forget that she wasn't always blonde.
Yes. And in fact, at the beginning of her career, she was thought of as the second coming of Judy Davis, who looked whom she looked like at the beginning of her career. And now those two actresses don't look anything alike to me.
Yeah, I mean, Dead Calm, and then you sort of have Days of Thunder. And I feel like it wasn't really until maybe To Die For where she starts really becoming this the icy blonde that we know her to be.
Yeah, right. I have to say, it's very interesting about Nicole Kidman because I think obviously almost maybe even the average person can name 10 to 15 performances of hers, and there'd be so many that are completely unrelated to others. Like To Die For is not like anything else she ever did, you know. Even The Others is not like anything she ever did. But there still is this prevailing image of her as, I'll say, kind of a Liv Ullmann type, where there's a porcelain vulnerability and is she going to crack feeling about whatever she does. But at the same time, she's like a Liv Ullmann who also gets to be the star of blockbusters. Not only does she do all these different types of roles, she does them at all these different types of scales. You know, like it can be the smallest possible movie or a gigantic, you know, blockbuster banger of a movie. She is just, if you will, beguiling in that way. She is just a shocking, fabulous actress who is routinely sublime in anything, everything. Weirdly, a performance of hers that I feel like goes underrated is Eyes Wide Shut, because that movie really is about, though her character has a journey and we're finding out about her like desires, et cetera, it's really more about Tom Cruise's foray into escape and this kind of dreamy underworld. But in that movie, she has a scene where she's high and she confesses this fantasy and situation to Tom Cruise. And when it begins, you kind of think, oh no, did she read about being high in a pamphlet or something? Like, is this going to be some broad acting? And then it goes into just this scorching character revealing moment that she's given us so many of over the years. Like, you know, it really peaked for a second with Big Little Lies, where it, like, everything we know her to be great at culminated in what seemed like a dissertation on how to give an emotional performance. But I think if people are looking to revisit a performance that is surprising and strange, that has a lot in it that's not in other movies, check out Eyes Wide Shut. A movie that, by the way, I don't love.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, I think the beginning when they're at the party is amazing. And then her confession to him is amazing. And then once he gets into like the bad romance video orgy, and they're concluding like they try to sum up what's happened to them at the end, it feels very pat and not up to how surreal the rest of the movie is.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my man loves those movies. Okay. That Vanilla Sky.
He looks amazing in Eyes Wide Shut. And he is, and yeah, he's so good in it too. I think it's his best performance, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, how could she have said no?
Precisely. You know? Precisely.
I mean, you get, when you watch, especially like their movies together, and when you watch Days of Thunder, you sort of get like the initial attraction between them, right? They are just two of the fucking hottest people in Hollywood at the time.
Yeah. And in Eyes Wide Shut, you might believe that they're the same height too. So movies are magic. We come to this place for magic. I'm looking at it right now.
A lot of angles going on in that movie.
Stanley's like, let's shoot up.
I do love that you mentioned that she is able to do, you know, films like The Hours, right? And then also just be in fucking Batman Forever. Like, she loves to work, for one. And I think that she, amongst, like, A-list actors, really sort of has that good balance of, I'm in really good films. And then I'm also in blockbusters that are generally fun and, you know, competently made too. You know, like there are like a couple of them that maybe falter, but you know, I just feel like she's rarely in something that you just feel is truly abysmal and a waste of your time.
There, I can only think of a couple of like bad movies. Like I've never seen the Aquaman movies because of course I am me, but like Birthday Girl, not a great movie, but otherwise it's a pretty excellent record. And in fact, she's somebody, and this is super rare, I think, who won the Oscar for Best Actress for The Hours, of course, and then afterwards seemed to have this kind of fuck it mentality where she went as dark mm-hmm. and weird as she wanted. Like, to follow that up with a movie like Birth, which I think most Nicole Kidman mm-hmm. fans would put in her top three, if not her best movie. Dogville People, Marco at the Wedding, I love too. But like Birth, and like, there are other strange movies that followed, like Fur, etc. But in Birth, the combination of both vulnerability that she gives, which obviously there's a famous scene where it's like locked on her face in a theater and you just see her sort of well up. And that's, again, like something Liv Ullmann would do.
Mm-hmm.
You just believe the paranormal undercurrent of this movie because of what she brings to it. Like, you have to believe it through her. There's a movie with Ellen Burstyn called Resurrection where there's a similar amount of amazing acting that has to occur for you to even get in on the ground floor in this movie, for you to even subscribe to what's happening. And that it's just tremendous. It's a tremendous performance. And like, her streak of movies during that decade is so unexpected for somebody who just won an Oscar. It's so unexpected.
I mean, girl, if you want to talk about Nicole Kidman really going for the gusto and just like having fucking fun in a film, you cannot do that without talking about the fucking Paperboy.
Oh, yes. Essential to her filmography. Yes.
It's wild watching that performance back and just being like, yeah, she read this, was like, let's just fucking do it. And honestly, there are so many parts of that film that I truly love. I ultimately think it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But I do sort of commend Lee Daniels for attempting.
It's one of those things where the movie feels like a detour in her career because so much of it is not what she quote unquote typically does. But then those movies, I think in retrospect, end up being essential to understanding what they're good at. It's like Meryl Streep and She-Devil. She never did another movie like that again. And yet if you see that movie, you're aware of this whole other like tentacle of her talent that you won't find anywhere else. And I want to say that's also true of To Die For, which I consider... Mm-hmm. In that time, there are three particular performances that come up all the time on this show. Alicia Silverstone in Clueless, Parker Posey in Party Girl, and Nicole Kidman in To Die For, where there is like a bubbly, self-possessed, subversive quality to the character. And I think some of it is in the script, which is terrific for To Die For, written by Buck Henry. But otherwise, you're seeing them bring some sort of essential part of their charisma that I don't think is written down, that they come up with themselves. And it feels like you realize they are able to elevate a script to another level just by their sheer being.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you could see a direct line sort of from the melodrama and camp in The Paperboy to her sort of realizing that she could play roles like that, but maybe a bit more serious and with a little less peeing on Zac Efron in Big Little Lies, and then also The Undoing, which, by the way, is somehow messier than The Paperboy.
The Undoing, the way that ended, I was just so upset. I was like, I don't need to see this long of a production about how something is inevitable. I don't know. They forgot to make it dramatic or something, even though she was great and her wigs were, of course, lustrous and I believe dragging on the street behind her.
I still have not seen Nine Perfect Strangers.
I can't. I mean, just like, that's one of those things, when there's no discussion about it, then you move on from it. Like, I end up choosing something like Baby Reindeer that everybody still is discussing. If I had to pick a single favorite Nicole Kidman performance of all time, I think I would have to go with Rabbit Hole. Because, one, the acting in that movie across the board, and you've got Miles Teller, you've got Aaron Eckhart, you've got Diane Wiest in a small... excellent role, is fabulous. But I think I just love when someone of Nicole Kidman's caliber tackles something that is such a triumph as a play, and they don't fuck with the play that much, and they want to just put the raw elements of it on screen for us to observe. And like, there's so many ways that can go wrong, or it's just, there's less tension. You know, I keep thinking of August Osage County, the movie, like, what was it missing? Like, something was just like a letter grade below the quality we expected. And in that movie, she is so wrenching. And also just, this is something we talk a lot about with Cate Blanchett and Carol. You just get to see a lot of somebody thinking. And when you're a good actor, that is mesmerizing to watch.
Yeah. I would say, you know, for me, her best performance for me is probably Moulin Rouge. You know, I just feel like she is able to infuse Satine with this sort of... not just vulnerability, but, you know, there's also, you talk about inevitability, right? You know, like, it's inevitable that, like, she's going to die.
Yeah.
But there's just something about this performance that feels like there's beauty in this inevitability. And she's just able to infuse so much, like I said, vulnerability, sort of like sadness into this tragic character, obviously, but also so much life and fun. And her scenes with Ewan McGregor are maybe some of the most romantic scenes I've ever seen Baz Luhrmann accomplish, and certainly up there with like romantic scenes in cinema in general. It's a fun, great movie, and I really love it. And I would say that underrated performances for me, I fucking love the film Stoker.
Oh, please. And I'm so glad that's become a monologue that, you know, gay people recite to each other at weddings, at funerals, etc.
That and Julianne Moore in Magnolia. Like, right. Those are up there in monologues.
I will say I do not like Moulin Rouge, but Nicole Kidman, I think, is amazing in it, specifically because you're right. She does have that emotional quotient that, of course, the movie, the romance, the passion, etc. But also... Mm. She's not just a delicate thing. She meets the excess of the movie. So she's playing a strange amount of levels at once. And of course, there's no movie like that either. So she feels particularly suited to how crazy the movie is.
I just want to commend her also for like still being at the top of her game.
Please.
Still turning out performances that are fucking mesmerizing. And recently going into performances that are kind of scary. You know, there's not that bubbly presence that there was in To Die For. I mean, it's their dark performances in Killing of a Sacred Deer. Yeah.
Northmen.
Fucking love. And Northmen. I was going to say Northmen, too. Like, she is terrifying in that movie. And I love all the scenes between her and Alexander Skarsgård in it. I'd also be remiss if I didn't tell people to check out Expats, which is a fantastic series. And she and Saraya Blue are amazing. In it. So watch that series.
And of course, Practical Magic is worth three good gifts. I don't know that beyond that, I needed much more from the movie, but like somebody levitating on a broom proud of themselves, we needed to see that.
Better than Bewitched, where she levitates on a broom.
Though I do want to say, I love that Nicole Kidman loves the original show Bewitched. That also gives her points in my book. When she did her 73 questions, she said that was her favorite TV show, which is brave after having made that movie.
Her 73 questions is maybe top three 73 questions ever.
Yes, except for when she sings those lyrics by her husband. Ooh, tough for me.
Those lyrics, honestly, pretty raw.
Pretty raw. Another reference.
All right, when we are back, keep it. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis.
Yes.
What's yours?
A minor Keep It, I guess. But Jennifer Lawrence was talking about Amy Schumer, who's, of course, you know, very pro-Israel. And she said Amy's choice to use her voice to speak for justice puts her under immense fire. I wouldn't say she navigates it so much as she throws her middle fingers up and walks away from negative comments like a gas station fire in a Michael Bay movie. My keep it this week is to the concept of middle fingers. I don't want to see that ever again. It just feels like something your aunt does in a photograph at a family reunion. It seems like something a Road Rules cast member does while they are bungee jumping. I just don't think it stands for anything anymore. It's one of those things like the word cringe or meh, where it just it's giving you a sense of power you have not earned. I find it just revolting in period.
Well, you know what?
Who are you, Pink? Throwing up that middle finger at me.
It's so funny. I can probably count on one hand the amount of times I've given someone the middle finger.
Yeah.
I think maybe one of the last times was like probably at like a big crowded music festival like Coachella or something. Like trying like, because you know there are people who sort of like plant themselves in places and like don't move, which I think is an antithesis to a dance floor in general. But also like, people are having to get through, and you had to get through too. So, like, just sort of like make yourself malleable.
Yeah.
And, like, I remember this, like, woman just sort of like really snapping at, like, people who were, like, moving past her. And it's like the middle finger is only useful for that when you're like, do it quickly and you're moving on.
Yeah.
And I think it came out, but I was also like, I have never done this as a kid at all. So,
also, just like, you made a body part move at me. It's just so strange. Use your words. You know, like, we're one of the more evolved species. Go ahead and speak.
Yeah.
Ira, what is your keep it?
Well, unfortunately, I am going to have to prove Roxy Andrews wrong when she said you can't read the doll, because my keep it goes to Normani.
Oh, no.
This week. The doll herself. I feel bad saying this too. But Normani finally released her single, 159. First of all, people were afraid that that was how long the song was going to be. But it is a full-length song. I kind of wish it were 1 minute and 59 seconds, though. Because it's mostly just boring.
Yeah.
And here's my specific thing about Normani. Obviously, we've waited 5 years plus for the album to come out. And she's done a whole, a couple of interviews recently. She did one with Elle. She has one out in the cut today, talking about the wait, just talking about wanting to get things right, et cetera. Okay, girl. I mean, it's just like the way that she is talking about this record, it is like it is her magnum opus, you know? And it is just sort of, there's just sort of this general attitude amongst her fans that she's an icon, she should be exalted, she is the future of music, when it's none of that has been brought to the table. You were in Fifth Harmony, a girl group which I actually really quite liked. You know?
Of course, yeah.
Camila Cabello has come out, and she's had a bunch of hits, but even that hasn't stopped her from this weird Charlie XCX aping career pivot that she's doing right now.
That song, I love it. I'm not loving it.
I do love it now. Oh, unfortunately, it's Pavlov. Okay, like it's been beaten into me so much. And I walk around and I just say like, I love it, I love it, I love it, I love it. Like it's in my head. I mean, don't you want to rock Lemons on the Chain with the V cut? Because I do.
Oh, okay. I don't relate to that in any way, but okay. Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just there's a specific quote from Normani in one of the interviews where she talks about motivation. And the interviewer says, I must admit, I'm a motivation lover. It comes on in the gay club and I'm like, let's go. But as she responds, it's crazy. Now I appreciate that song so much more than I did. I cried. I boohoo cried. I was like, I don't want this to be my single. Then I had total creative control over the video, which meant a lot. I just wanted to feel represented. Now I get it. I understand it more now. I get you want to be this R&B girl with these sort of like sleepy, sort of...
Solange-ified music.
Not even Solange-ified. It sounds like most of her songs sound like the opening 30 seconds of One in a Million before Aaliyah starts singing. It sounds like the low humming beat in the beginning. There's just no really sort of gymnastics to the song. There's no going any different levels, you know? And I just feel like 159 is sort of like a very ho-hum single after waiting for so long, and it doesn't make me feel positive about the upcoming album. And when I critiqued it online, many of her stans were like, you don't know what the whole album's gonna sound like. It's just a single. And I'm like, this goes back to the whole Billboard Hot 100 thing that we were talking about before the show. I'm wearing a Post Malone shirt. Shout out to Post Malone for being number one on Billboard Hot 100. But it's just, what does music even mean anymore? You know? Because in my day, a lead single was supposed to get you anticipated for an album.
Yeah,
okay?
Right.
It doesn't exist to just be on streaming and then maybe your fans can say, oh, well, you know, like, I'll listen to the album when it comes out, but I don't really care. I mean, in my day, like, you had to go and buy a fucking single at the record store. You had to request it on the radio. You had to wait to watch the video on MTV, which means that that single better be fucking good.
Yeah,
okay?
Right.
And it also
right.
means that it's going to tell you what the album's going to be sounding like. Motivation was a great single, and I get that maybe it wasn't the exact sort of flavor of R&B that she wanted, but the fact that you also just sort of like hate it, and we get it, like, listen, a lot of our favorite artists hate some of their favorite songs.
Right.
We talk about it all the time on this show, but if you really hate the one song in your short solo career that all your fans really love and people who even aren't your fans loved, then sort of what are we doing here? And then I'm thinking that just maybe your solo career might not be for me.
Also, I mean, it's interesting, like the amount of times somebody puts out like a big pop song and it turns out to be the one they don't like. It's always in my head that Alanis Morissette didn't want Ironic on Jagged Little Pill, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, obviously that's like, that went to number one. But also you like kind of get it too. It's like, oh yeah, I guess the theme of that is like a little corny or whatever. Like, I think being perceived as corny is a fear for a lot of people when it comes to pop music. But also, I mean, Normani's up against Espresso Culture, which I'm sorry has taken over my brain, girl.
It's such a fucking good song.
And also, the lyrics do not get dumber. It does not get dumber than the lyrics to that song. It's me, Espresso. I mean, we used to have English as a language. We used to speak it.
I'm working late.
But it is an amazing song. We're talking about Sabrina Carpenter's new single. It's still, I think, at number 22 on the Hot 100, even though Taylor Swift's completely dominated.
The thing is, it was higher a week ago. I believe it was at 7. And then, you know, the tortured poets all started turning their ovens on.
Taylor and her 16 versions of Howl all made it onto the list.
So I think that once Taylor hysteria dies down, then Espresso will be going back to the top. But I don't know. It's just, I want music, especially if you're a pop star, should be fun. And if you're an R&B star, it should be sexy, I guess. And I'm not really getting any of it. And I feel bad about, the sort of, I want this creative freedom, et cetera, but it's been 5 years. And if you want the creative freedom, do anything else.
Yeah, no.
You know? Or drop that Max Martin produced album with all these songs you maybe don't like, and at least use that to have the capital to release a second album that you do like. You know? I mean, her fans are always comparing her sort of like to Beyonce and things. And it's just, you have to get to that level first. And just because Beyonce left Destiny's Child and then started solo, like Fifth Harmony to Normani's solo career is not the exact same thing. Mm. Okay. They're not even the same kind of artists, to be honest. They're releasing different kinds of music.
I feel like it's always a good idea to release the Max Martin single. Because if you look at everything he's done, if it were a bad music, ultimately, that would be pretty rare for his catalog. And we would still remember it for that reason. Oh, remember when Max Martin made bad music that one time? Go ahead and put that out.
Also, most of our classic artists have a first album that nobody really gives a fuck about or even remembers.
Carly Rae Jepsen, We Speak Your Name. Yes.
Do Not Come for This Kiss.
No. Before that, the Tug of War album. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry, we don't speak about that one.
I love that. I love that Carly Rae Jepsen album. Yeah.
And, you know, like Janet Jackson had Dream Street and then that other one.
Right. Before Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis were like, actually, we have amazing hats.
Anyway, this sounds like a very negative Keep It, but it's also a, I'm somehow still rooting for you, girl, Keep It. Because I feel like even when people are making jokes about Normani online, it's because they still care.
Yeah.
If we didn't care, we wouldn't be talking about you at all, you know? So I would love nothing more for her to be topping the charts and having a hit. I love more music.
But in the meantime, we're going to be having a hit of ketamine next to a pool in Palm Springs while Espresso plays. Baby, the summer is here. Yeah.
I'm working late because I'm a singer. That's art, though.
It is goofballs. By the way, I'm working late because I'm a singer. You look so cute wrapped around my finger. I just want to say, singer and finger don't rhyme. And I want to say that what she has to do to the word singer to make it rhyme is, again, a new landmark in stupidity. Singer. I mean, it's like new to the language. She's introducing so much here, and I hope we don't pass up how progressive it is.
Okay, well, first of all, that is a classic in pop music, okay? Sometimes you have to rhyme words that do not make sense. I think our friend Jan even tweeted about this today, about the classic song Somebody Loved by Leighton Meester, where she's melding in the words Paris, France to Michigan. It's I love it. I love it when pop stars are like, you know what? Here are the words to the song. Here's the melody. I'm going to make it fit.
Right. And nobody's paying that much attention, so moving right along. You know, not everything has to be song of the year, you know?
I know I'm Mountain Dew it for you. I mean, I need that on a shirt.
Right. I think you're going to get it.
Yeah. Mountain Dew's going to send it to me next week.
That's our episode. Thank you to Chris Perfetti, who is delightful.
Yeah.
And thank you, Nicole Kidman, for being tall and willowy and always fair-skinned. We need you out there in the world representing SPF-deprived culture.
Yeah, and also I need that AMC ad. I'm tired of playing with you, girl.
Even like the losers who like clap when the airplane lands aren't clapping anymore for this ad. We need a renewal.
Yeah, I mean, I heard someone say, woo, like when the ad came on recently, and I was like, still, it's been 3 years, girl. And this is your first, like, it's your second time seeing it?
Right, yeah. Shocking.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you next week. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are Chris Lord and CJ Siege Polkinghorne. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James. Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroot, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.